Teresa Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing America After 9/11, a new frontline documentary that traces the U.S. response to the September 11th terrorist attacks and the devastating consequences that unfolded across four presidencies. The film examines the consequences of the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. funding and supporting extremists, the lies about weapons of mass destruction, the torture policies in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and the rise of xenophobia here at home. Here is the trailer for America After 9/11.
When 9/11 happened, we were embarking upon a new era in American history.
It ushered in an age of fear.
It was about us versus them.
Mistrust.
2 decades of feeling like the government doesn't listen to you.
And division.
The biggest national security threat facing the United States is internal.
A 20-year epic story of America After 9/11.
America After 9/11 is available for viewing now, and you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Joining us is Michael Kirk, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of Frontline's America After 9/11. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's nice to be back here.
It's great to have you, Michael. And again, thanks to you and your team for making another important documentary. This one is 2 hours long. It is based on dozens of original interviews. You drew on archives of hundreds of interviews from 20 years of filmmaking about the 9/11 attacks and their aftermath. Michael, what were some of the questions you and your team were trying to find answers to or examine in this new film?
Well, because we had made all those films you just described, Rose, we didn't want to go back down. We didn't want to just do a kind of pull together of all the stuff we did and knew during that Shakespearean drama that was the Bush administration and so forth. So we decided to step back and say, look, there's a lot of division, polarization, whatever, in the America we know now. And knowing that our movie was going to start with the steps of the Capitol building on the night of 9/11, where members, a bipartisan group of congressional members, sang a cappella the America the Beautiful. It's such a stunning, contrasting a vision of an America then when you think about where we are now. So we said to ourselves, I wonder to what extent what has happened, the big things that happened during the last 20 years, Osama bin Laden getting away, weapons of mass destruction, the turn to Iraq, torture, the dark side stuff from Dick Cheney, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, all the things that have happened. To what extent did they add to the division, maybe even in some cases create the division, polarization, anger, distrust of the government that exists in America now and that kind of laid the groundwork for Donald Trump in 2016. So that was the big idea we had, and the big finish of the big idea we had was that on those very same Capitol steps on January 6th, 2021, there were Americans taking that building, doing the kind of destruction al-Qaeda had wanted to do on 9/11 and hadn't been able to. In other words, Americans were doing the work that I think Osama bin Laden would have been very happy about. Mm.
I think it's also so important just to remind people of what happened, who made decisions, what went on behind the scenes. Yeah. Because when 9/11 happened, we did not have social media and we didn't really have this sort of 24/7. I mean, we did have 24/7 news, but it was very, very different. We're in such a different place now in terms of the news we get, attention spans. Yeah. And I noticed on a lot of the comments on the YouTube film, people really said thank you for putting this in context. They said it's important just to have that context, especially now when we're just in this sort of soundbite media world.
Well, I think that's right. And also a tremendous number of people in America now were not alive during 9/11. Right. People who are adults now who didn't know it or all of the 9/11 things we're talking about were happening when they were kids. So who was paying attention? So that, I think I agree with the commenters on YouTube and with you, Rose. I think it is important to try to put all that in context and talk about who the individuals were, who Colin Powell was, and what it meant to have Colin Powell go to the United Nations and make the case for America taking over a sovereign nation like Iraq by force. All of those moments, we tried to put them in enough of a context that I think people would understand without already knowing about it. That was part of the challenge, certainly, of making it, was to step back regularly and say, wait a minute, do people really know what that means? And I hope we succeeded more times than we didn't.
What really struck you about the interview you all did with Colin Powell? Because what he did at the UN was a major turning point in this so-called war on terror.
Yeah, I think so, too. People often ask me what were the big moments. And I think the turn to weapons of mass destruction, first, not getting Osama bin Laden. Second, the turn to the axis of evil moment where America decides to widen the war to states and the first state becomes Iraq and the first leader becomes Saddam Hussein. Making that case on behalf of the White House, which was already losing some of the 95% approval rating that George W. Bush had, was Secretary of State Colin Powell, who'd also been a general and the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Powell, the black Secretary of State in America, which mattered an awful lot then and I think would matter now. He his chief of staff told us that he had the kind of approval ratings that matched up with Mother Teresa. So for Bush to ask him to step out there and do it was a big ask. And for Powell to put his reputation on the line was a big risk, especially when he, I'm not sure, he had told people he didn't really believe the evidence he was seeing from the Central Intelligence Agency and the newspapers. The American News had collaborated to make the case, the New York Times and many others that collaborated, that's too strong a word, but I don't know, had unabashedly gone along with the case that was being made by the Bush administration to go to war because of weapons of mass destruction. So there's Powell. He makes the case, and then it turns out not very long after we invade that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And he hears this in a series of drip, drip, drip phone calls from George Tenet, the head of the CIA, who he made sit behind him when he made the speech so that Tenet would be, for history, always on camera behind him. To interview him, to ask him about it, was essential. He put everything on the line, including the believability of the American government, and it turned out not to be true. It must be, and I think it is to him, and I think he sort of says it, he blames the intelligence agency and says, well, I was just a salesman. But we all, I think, know better than that, given who he was and what he risked and what's happened to him, which is that I think people began not to believe top officials of the American government when they made these assertions. And it was not the first time it's ever happened in history, but it was definitely, as you suggest, Rose, an important moment. And I think Powell knows that.
Right. Well, and also on your website, you can read the entire interview you did with Colin Powell and others, or watch it. And we have links to all of those interviews, yourcallradio.org. Going back a bit before that Colin Powell speech at the United Nations, 2 weeks after the attacks, a small CIA strike force arrived in Afghanistan, and they basically said that they needed to deal with the extremists in charge of Afghanistan, people harboring bin Laden and the Taliban. And Gary Schroen, a CIA officer, casually says, when I began to distribute money, $200,000 here, $250,000 for this, I think that they were convinced that we were sincere. And this is just really incredible, Michael, because a lot of reporters who've been covering Afghanistan for many, many years are now tweeting again about all of the money and the corruption over the last 20 years. And when you see Gary Schroen so casually talk about distributing hundreds of thousands of dollars, You just have to wonder who was calling the shots at this point. See, the CIA, the Pentagon, who basically said, let's distribute all of this money.
When it happened, America was not exactly on a war footing. The young new president, who'd only been president for 9 months, was flabbergasted and felt guilty. Nearly 3,000 people had died on his watch. His administration there, the CIA had been making and continues to make charges that they had tried to warn the White House, and the White House hadn't done it. Nevertheless, the CIA had a person named Kofor Black, who was the head of the counterterrorism unit at the Central Intelligence Agency. And he is a real go-getter, for lack of a stronger word, a tough guy, classic CIA guy that would be in the movies. He's the guy that uttered the phrase, now the gloves come off. And he went to the White House very early, promised the president of the United States that they would bring, if they were given the authority, to go in and get him right away, but without waiting for the military, without waiting for a buildup, without waiting for diplomacy. Just let us get in there. We'll get in there and we'll cut their heads off and bring them back on a pike with flies on their eyes, is what he said. Schroen says to us in the film that he was under orders from Kofor Black to cut bin Laden's head off and put it on ice and bring it home on ice. He was shocked by the orders, and he never heard such a thing. But that was the attitude that was happening. And I think in the country as well, in lots of ways, revenge, revenge, revenge. And to get those CIA people in there, they sent in small forces. They said to the president, we're ready. Our maps are all up to date. We can get in there and get them, promising to get Osama bin Laden and knowing that they had to get rid of the Taliban along the way. So air power was going to blow up the Taliban, reduce them to rubble, and deals that would be cut by the CIA with ragtag groups with Northern Alliance people and warlords who'd been fighting the Taliban and the Soviets and others for decades. There's been war in Afghanistan. So we bought and paid through our CIA for one group of people to help us chase bin Laden and take down the Taliban. And we did. We reduced the Taliban. And Mr. Schroen told me they would fly in on these C-17s or C-300s or whatever they were. And they'd had these platens of just millions of dollars of cash. And they would land and pass it around to show, he says in the film, that America was meant business. We were there to do it. And we bought brutality.
So the U.S. also dropped massive bombs, as you say in the film, as the guests and the experts say, the Taliban were driven from Kabul, and then bin Laden leaves for Tora Bora. The United States and allied forces bombed Tora Bora, but could not get bin Laden. And then bin Laden and his fighters went to Pakistan, and the United States military basically failed. Then bin Laden produces videos to basically taunt the United States. And in comes Dick Cheney, who does not want international law to get in the way of the treatment of Afghans and others. They thought that the law was constraining them. And it is so important to just revisit torture and what that did to the United States. This is just really important to revisit. So let's hear a clip. This is from a new Frontline documentary, America After 9/11.
Cheney believes the only way you can fight these people is with accurate intelligence and take some fairly, what he calls, robust measures to break their will to resist.
So where do you do that? And how do you do it? You keep it secret from the Justice Department. You keep it overseas in countries that agree to keep it secret. You build these things with CIA money so that nobody knows this is going on, except vaguely the president and, of course, the people in the CIA.
They would test the secret program on Abu Zubaydah, suspected of running a terrorist training camp. His story was revealed when the United States Senate issued what was known as the Torture Report in 2014.
At approximately 6:20 p.m., Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded for the first time.
Zubaydah's personal drawings illustrate his story.
Over a 2.5 hour period, Abu Zubaydah coughed, vomited, and had involuntary spasms of the torso and extremities.
He describes it to the Red Cross, and he can't breathe, and he's beginning to drown. And the feeling of drowning is terrifying.
It went on for more than 2 weeks. Waterboarding, beatings, confinement in small spaces, sleep deprivation, freezing. Some who knew the program's secrets said it didn't work and wasn't worth it.
We devolved and became the person that we were going after. That's what it meant. That was the consequence. We lost our moral authority around the globe. Remember, even in countries that hated us, they were crying over what happened to America. And we squandered it. What a waste. What a waste. What a waste.
That is a clip from the new Frontline documentary, America After 9/11. We're speaking with Michael Kirk, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of the new documentary. Michael, what are your thoughts on the what you heard from people 20 years later about U.S. torture policies? And no one has really been held responsible for this.
It's, yes, I mean, it's you had this wonderful, you had this amazing, alarming contrast in the Bush administration. Bush himself had read biblical passages in his first speech, said we were the good guys, we were after the evildoers, that America was the bright, shining light of democracy, our values would help us. And at the same time, he was saying that Dick Cheney had, of course, initiated and started what became known as the dark side, which is certainly torture. He was saying the American people are not gonna know about the methods and means that we're gonna have to use to win this war. Cheney himself, who was deeply paranoid about if there's even one chance of an attack, a terrorist attack. He was going to do whatever was necessary, by any means necessary, including keeping prisoners in Guantanamo so they didn't get into the United States constitutional system. You know, just literally all of those things. The effect of it 20 years later is even more profound in some ways. A lot of the people we talked to just said, well, there it is. If you say you're the good guys and people believe you and you tell the American people we are the good guys, and then they discover that this is happening, what happens to their trust in you? What does the world think? So that the person talking at the end there was Mark Rossini, a former FBI agent and interrogator who walked away from interrogating some prisoners the way the CIA was doing it. The FBI itself walked away because they believed it was all illegal. So, what was the effect on people who looked at it from 20 years? I think it's just even more stark, even more powerful, and an even more profound example of the power of the poison of fear, the paranoia in America that also matched up with xenophobia and, you know, racism and all the other things that that grew out of the way we acted over there for 20 years.
And NPR reported that about 3/4 of the 40 men still imprisoned at Guantanamo are forever prisoners who are being held without charge or trial, some for nearly 2 decades now. One former detainee, Mansour Adaifi, just wrote a book, really amazing book, called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo.
Yeah, he's in the film. He's in our film. It's amazing to see him and amazing to hear from him.
What about responsibility, Michael? I mean, that's the other thing that just kept coming up in this film. So many of the people who came up with these policies have in some ways reinvented themselves. I mean, to think that George W. Bush is painting and I believe wrote a book about immigration and did these softball interviews not just pretty recently about his new book about immigrants. I mean, a lot of these people have really successfully reinvented themselves. When it comes to some of the people who made high level decisions at the military, I mean, they're making a lot of money now working at think tanks.
Well, in almost every case, what happened during Bush set the table for what happened during Obama. And Ben Rhodes, who was very close to Obama throughout his entire administration, tells us in the film that Obama would have not been elected if it wasn't for what Trump did in Iraq. Obama ran as the anti-war president. But Obama as president was not successful in closing Guantanamo, as he had hoped to promise, did pull us out of Iraq, but then had to go back in when ISIS rose up and took over or went to, you know, took land and everything else in Iraq, tried to enhance and grow the war in Afghanistan, thought he could win. And when he couldn't win, when it was discovered that his surge had failed, he turned to other methods that the CIA had done during Bush. So and moved to a tenfold increase in drone warfare and targeted killings of thousands of people and children, and then that all moves into the hands of Donald Trump. So each president in our film, each president in America, has been stuck in the quagmire, made it even worse in lots of ways, and their legacy will be forever tarnished by what happened in that the nicest word you could call it is a misadventure, the horror over there. I hasten before I leave Obama for a minute. I hasten to add, he did stop the torture. He did try to stop Guantanamo, but couldn't because the Congress voted 90-6 against him. That's how profound the fear was in America about all of this. So, you know, what will happen to them? History forgets. Each president has done something worse than the one before. Certainly Trump, by bringing the war home and fighting the war on the streets of America and changing the names of Islamic terrorism to Antifa and Black Lives Matter, has certainly made things worse. So, and what will be his legacy on the war? Negotiated with the Taliban, how much of what happened in the last few weeks there is a result of what he did and what he negotiated? I mean, it's just in every way the end of America being this big shining city on the hill, or whatever they used to call it in Reagan's time, or even on September 10th, 2001, this superpower, which is what this benign superpower that was going to export democracy to the world. All of that is gone. That our international relations have been, and reputation has obviously been deeply harmed across the three presidencies and really four when you think about what happened in Afghanistan recently and domestically. My God, the loss of faith and trust in the government and the truth, and the press has played a role in that, and Fox News and right-wing radio have played a role in that to such an extent that you have coronavirus coming. Nobody wants to get a vaccination. Mm. People ask me sometimes, well, what is there going to be a time when people can all stand on the Capitol steps and sing God Bless America again? And I just point to the vaccine and the conspiracy theories about all of it and say America's broken right now.
You know, just to go over a little bit more with Obama, because again, it's just so important to remember all of this. Yeah. I mean, he receives the Nobel Peace Prize right after he became president and gives a fairly hawkish speech. And then General Stanley McChrystal wanted a surge, 15,000 additional troops. Obama agreed. The Taliban at that time killed a lot of soldiers. The U.S. deaths surged under Obama to almost 2,000. And as you said, he tried to close Guantanamo with an executive order. Michael, it's really important to also remember how a number of Democrats rallied behind the Bush administration's claims about WMD. You've got speeches from Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Joe Biden, basically saying the same things that Bush, Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice said. And then it's just important to remember that Democrats also wanted Guantanamo to remain open. That was one of the main reasons why it did not close.
This is a different America at the time than it was before, and than it is now. Now we're in our tribes and really angry at each other, and in all kinds of ways, largely born out of the actions of all those things. If Democrats did that, somebody in the film says, I mean, there's the three future presidential candidates, Hillary, John Kerry, and Joe Biden, all three supporting Bush and the war in and the weapon, the war for the weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. How can people trust, if they can't trust the Republicans because of Bush and Trump, how can they trust Democrats? That's what people tell us in the film as well. Who do you trust? If you're an American and you look at the people who are the powerful Democrats and the powerful Republicans, it's what's sobering about watching the film, because it's not like, you know, political rhetoric. You can watch it happen, and I think you can see it happen right before your eyes.
I want to play one more clip from America after 9/11. Drone strikes became much bigger during the Obama administration. And this is so important because obviously it has had a devastating effect on Afghans. Here's a clip about drone strikes in America after 9/11.
The drone program that started under George Bush becomes much bigger under Obama. Not just in terms of the number of drone strikes, but in terms of the types of people that can be hit.
And suddenly, the controversy that accompanied an arrest and detention and putting them in Guantanamo no longer mattered, because you could put them on a kill list and very few members of the American public would be riled up by that.
Yeah, you are clear to engage.
Hey, ready.
Good
shot.
Obama personally reviewed many of the strikes.
Every day, every week, someone would come from his national security team and say, you know, we've got this band of six terrorists on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. We have a 45-minute window in which we can kill them. What do you want to do? And very, very often, he would say, kill them.
Let me know when you see the target area, and I'll start the bomb down.
Obama authorized 10 times as many drone strikes as Bush had. Hundreds during his time in office. Almost 4,000 people killed, including hundreds of civilians.
Of course, the downside with the drones was the collateral damage. Women, children got killed in some of these drone strikes.
The image of the drone becomes a very disturbing influence over millions of people all over the Muslim world, and even in the West.
When we start thinking of a drone as the answer to all problems, terrorism, this is the one we fail. A drone cannot kill an ideology, cannot kill a message, cannot kill a narrative. So every time we kill someone, 10 people came to take their position.
That is a clip from Frontline's new documentary, America After 9/11, which you can watch now. Find a clip at yourcallradio.org. Find a link at yourcallradio.org. Michael, I think it's so important to play that because tomorrow is the anniversary of 9/11. And there's just so many angles to take, so many important stories to tell. But it's also just so important to remember how these policies have affected the people of Afghanistan and Iraq. And these drone strikes have had devastating consequences.
Yes, and they're the weapon of the future. You know, this is this and assassination squads have become the weapon of choice in lots of ways. It's relatively sanitary in terms of you don't lose American forces. That becomes a big part of the American strategy. Was maybe Afghan army people get killed, but the American numbers are going to be down. Freeze those numbers. And the generals are told to do this. So what's the way to fight a war without Americans being killed? You know, you do it from the air. The scary thing, of course, about drones is somebody told us, we didn't put it in the film, but an expert on drones essentially said, if we have them soon, how long is it going to be before somebody else has them? And then they're flying in the skies over America. So yes, it's a very, 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 it was a choice Obama made because he couldn't leave. He was in the process. He was doing what one person in the film said, the common nomenclature in the military and the intelligence agencies is called mowing the lawn. You can't leave because of the country, because if the terrorists do launch an attack from there, that's the end of your presidency. But you also can't, you know, you can't fight a war there. You can't keep fighting and dying because you're not going to win. So mowing the lawn is doing things that keep terrorists from forming up in a place like Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda came from. And the way you mow the lawn is with a drone.
Well, Michael, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'd love to have you back just to talk about, you know, what have the media learned? Where do we go from here? As you say, drones are the new warfare. And we just got an email from LaWanda who said, this is one of the best shows I've heard on 9/11. Your guest is amazing. Thank you for the show. So, Michael, as always, thanks to you and thanks to your team for making another important documentary.
And thanks to you, Rose, for talking about it and bringing it to your listeners.
Thank you. Michael Kirk is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of Frontline's new film, America After 9/11. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. It's also important to remember Daniel Hale, who leaked information on the U.S. drone warfare program. He was sentenced to 45 months in prison. We talked about Daniel Hale and the information he exposed about a month ago. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we are going to discuss coverage of the deadly Hurricane Ida, California's wildfires. How are the media connecting extreme weather events to the climate crisis? We'll also talk about a new Guardian investigation exposing big oil's woke washing as the new climate science denialism. We'll be back after this.